It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We talk a lot on the show about outdoor recreation, and on the whole, those topics are about things we do just because we want to, or for fitness, or because they add to our lives. But Alaska's outdoors is also for food and the way of life that goes with harvesting food. Our topic today is fish camp. Native Alaskans all over the state go to riverside fish camps for the summer to harvest salmon and as part of an ancient way of life. And a lot of commercial fishermen have fish camps at set net sites where they catch the fish going by. They make a little bit of money and to live and to sustain themselves in these wild places. Today we'll be talking about subsistence and commercial fish camp and exploring both how this lifestyle works and what it means. And I have two guests today who I am just extremely proud to be able to introduce you to, people that I've respected and known a long time. Nancy Lord is an author of many books, an author whose work I admire very much. And one of her books is a classic called Fish Camp, which talks about her experience set net fishing on Cook Inlet. She joins us from Homer. Thanks for being with us, Nancy.
Hi, Charles. Yeah, happy to be here.
And Mike Williams joins us from Akiak. Mike is a pretty well-known guy, I would say it's fair to say. He's an Iditarod musher. He's a leader in the culture and educational scene in Southwest Alaska. And he is a subsistence fisherman and hunter. He's in Akiak right now, getting ready to head down to Akiachuk to fish camp. And then I guess some going for berries after that, eh, Mike?
Yep, I certainly will, and glad to be here with you.
Well, thanks a lot for being with me. And fish camp, harvesting the fish going by in the river is something that has gone on forever, and it's I bet you've been doing it since before you could remember, eh, Mike?
Yes, I can remember, coming to and at the fish camp every year, and we were born with it, and living there every year, right after the ice goes out, we prepare the fish camp and repair everything that was damaged by the floods or et cetera, and working on our smokehouses, our tent site, and our racks. And, done that ever since I can remember, and as a child, and up to today when I can barely walk.
You could barely walk, but you could mush all the way to Nome. Yeah, we know all about that. So how many people are down there in Akiachuk? In place, in case people don't know the geography, you're upriver from Bethel, the lower Kuskokwim area there. How many people are out in your camp working?
There's my camp, and my brother-in-law has a camp right next to us, and then my mother-in-law and my father-in-law's fish camp is the third place over, and then my brother-in-law has a house and a fish camp, and then my brother-in-law. So there's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, cabins, and 5 smokehouses and 5 racks. And we, our whole family is there every summer. I used to fish camp about 5 miles upriver from Akiachuk, and the whole village of Akiak used to have a fish camp right there. But I decided to move down with my in-laws. So it's been like 30 years that I've been there in our Akiachuk fish camp with my in-laws. So about 25 of us are there.
Wow. And it's a family affair, many, many generations?
Oh, family, everybody is there, all the kids and all the puppies. And I had my dogs there at times that I've decided to keep them in Akiak for the summer these days. But I always take 15 to 20 puppies so all the kids can play with them in the fish camp, and they're well socialized. But again, a family, and we always look forward for the summer, and it's bonding and family, and it's spiritual. So everything together, and it's a good feeling.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to a friend from northern Alaska about going out to camp, and one of the things he expressed that meant the most to him was that whatever may be happening in the winter, everybody's sort of doing their own thing in the winter. But in the summer, when they're out in camp, everybody in the family has a job. Everybody has a role that they're doing. And so you've got teamwork, and you've got this feeling in your family of teamwork where everybody's working together. And I told him, well, it's kind of like that when I go camping. I don't have a fish camp, but when I go camping, yeah, there's a teamwork aspect that makes real important for your family. And he said, wow, you have that too. I bet that's part of your experience out there, is this teamwork in the family and everybody pulling together.
Yes. I love to fish, and that's what we try to get fish before the bad, you know, the rainy season arrives. And we try to get that fish early on, as much as we can, because once rains hit, then, you know, some of the fish go sour. But everybody, once we get the fish and get them to the site there, everybody, all our women and children are helping. And the women are cutting the fish, and our kids, my grandkids, are doing the washing, and they're washing the fish, and everybody is busy, and getting some willows, small willows for the chum. You know, we make sure that the carcass is spread out, and so the women do the slabs on the kings, and also we dry the heads as well, and they make them in slabs, and they do a wonderful job. They're carefully done, and salt, put a little bit of salt or other ingredients in there to make it palatable, and it tastes good. And we hang them in the racks, and then some of those bigger fish we make strips out of them, and it is done I think we hang them for a few days and then pair the slabs of fish, and once they are ready to be smoked, we then transport them into the smokehouse, and we smoke them until they are dry and smoked, and then we go ahead and put them away. We get our birch, cottonwood, big willows, and that's what we use to smoke our fish with most of the summer, and we just got through putting them away into freezers, or we dig a hole in the ground and put them in where it's a cool place so they won't be spoiled. So it's a lot of work from the beginning of the summer and until like first week or by this time of the year, everybody is done by most of this year, the summer. And now we're putting them away, And now we're focusing on the salmon berries, and they are ripening right now, and everybody's camping out, getting the salmon berries right now, and then the blueberries come, and then red berries and blackberries. And so every, you know, the season goes on to getting ready for the winter to survive.
Yeah.
And so it's a good feeling.
Yeah. And then hopefully at the end you've got what you need. And just quick, in a good year, how much fish are you going to put up? How many pounds or how many fish?
We try to put up 100 slabs of king salmon. And it depends on the size of the family. And I'm fishing for three families. So we just been focusing on getting 100 slabs and maybe 50 strips. So we're getting about 150 king salmon if we can, and that's what we can do, like 50 fish per family for the winter. And we supplement them with chums. There's plenty of reds and chums, and that's what we supplement them with. And I think we try to get about 400 reds and smoked and cut, and about we would like to get about 800 chum for human consumption, and maybe 1,500 to split them for our dogs. And we used to get more in the days when everybody had dogs, and but that's what that's the average.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of fish. That's a tremendous amount
of
work. So I can see why you need all those people working. Hey, that's Mike Williams. He's a subsistence fisherman on the lower Kuskokwim. He's talking to us from Akyak, and we're going to talk to him more. But I also want to talk to my other guest, Nancy Lord. Nancy's a writer. She's written on a lot of important topics. She did a recent book on climate change and how that's affecting our streams and a lot of other aspects of Alaska's natural environment. But Nancy also wrote a classic book called Fish Camp, which is a very contemplative, meditative book on being on the west side of Cook Inlet and working a set net site, catching the fish as they go by. And I'm really grateful that you could be with us, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks, Charles. Yeah.
So tell me about your fishing operation. I realize you're not out at the set net site anymore, but what were you were going after reds, and it was just you and one other person, right?
Yeah, myself and my partner, starting in the late 70s, and I guess we fished for about 25 or so years, and now we still have our cabin, and but don't commercial fish anymore. It was a commercial operation, but it was really never very, high-end. It was more of a lifestyle. For us, we just really enjoyed spending our summers on that other side of the inlet, and being with our neighbors over there. And what Mike was talking about, the importance of family and the time spent together. And though we were just the two of us as family, we really valued our neighbors there who were not too close, but several miles on either side, strung along the beach. We'd get together and. I think back how much storytelling went on, how much we learned. We learned from our neighbors how to smoke fish, and we always had a smokehouse, and took fish out of our catch for our own personal use, and shared that around, and canned our own fish, and was a great part of my life. And it's funny that you call my book a classic. It was written in, or it was published in 1997, and you know, I kind of look back at it now, and it is sort of historical because there aren't that many people sort of living that, you know, more leisurely way of life anymore.
Well, one of the things that I enjoyed about the book was your description of being on the beach and the time between, I mean, Mike is fishing in the river, so it's not, there's no worry about issues about tides, but you're fishing with the tides and you're living a life that is regulated by the tidal cycles rather than by the clock. And it introduces the reader to this whole feeling of a different way of measuring life or measuring your days going by.
Right. I think that's certainly, I mean, it's something I learned from Alaska Native cultures, but also I think it kind of goes along with living in Alaska, where you do live by tides and by seasons. And, I mean, I certainly, you know, experience that sort of settling into the natural rhythms and you know, other than having to pay attention to openings and closures of fishing periods, really sort of living without, you know, without timepieces or, you know, not paying attention to clocks too much.
And the sun is always up. It doesn't matter too much what time it is, really.
Right.
So set netters are kind of the, I don't know if we call them the poor stepchild of commercial fishermen, but you have a skiff, but you don't have a big boat, and set netters don't get rich by and large. It's more of something you do that makes some money in the summer, but it supports a lifestyle to a certain extent. Agreed? Or some have really good sites do make a lot of money.
Some on the, certainly on the east side of the inlet in particular, are very, you know, kind of big operations and very productive around the Kenai and Kasilof rivers usually. But set netting, I think, is distinct by being a family fishery for so many people. That's the great thing about seeing kids kind of, you know, grow up in it. And I mean, that wasn't our case specifically, but it was for our neighbors. And, you know, having little kids out in the boats helping pick fish and running along the beach and you know, growing up in it. So just a very much a family-oriented thing. And the idea that you were then off the boat when you weren't fishing and you would have a cabin on the beach and you could, you know, pick berries and do all those other things that go along with the way of life.
Yeah, and you're off the grid. There's no electricity out there, right? You're sort of
right where we were. Yeah, no, yeah.
How'd you pick that particular spot?
When we decided to get into fishing, it happened to be after a really big year, and there weren't very many operations or locations for sale, and it was what we could find and afford.
So you just sort of go to a broker and say what's out there, and somebody's selling one, and you buy it.
Yeah, I don't think there were actually brokers at the time, but we kind of just asked around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then did you have to go out and build your own cabin, or was it all set up for you?
There was a small cabin there. We later built a larger cabin.
Did you look forward all winter to getting out there and into that space? I mean, what was the attraction of it, I guess? What made it special for you?
Yeah, and again, it has to do with cycles. Many of those early years, I was actually working in Juneau in the winter, kind of intensely down there with the legislature, and then to be able to leave that and do something completely different that was physical rather than mental, was sort of part, you know, became part of my rhythm of life, and then, you know, went on and did other winter work in later years, but. Yeah, it was always sort of that going from, you know, some kind of work to a more physical, as you said, maybe, you know, meditative, slower kind of life. And then at the end of the summer, kind of wrapping that up and going on and doing something else.
Is that hard physical work, picking the fish out of the net and putting the net out? I mean, you end up with sore muscles at the end of the day?
Yeah, no, it was pretty... We you know, we because of the large tides where we were and all that, we were always moving our nets, you know, picking them up and resetting them, and we were on a very rocky beach, and we didn't I mean, a lot of people on the east side have tractors and four-wheelers and things, but we had everything was manual for us.
Mm.
moving all the nets from, you know, up high, you know, down to the beaches and hauling them around.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Our topic today is Fish Camp, and you've just been hearing from Nancy Lord, who is author of the book Fish Camp, who's joining us from Homer. And Mike Williams is out in Akiak. He's a Lower Kuskokwim subsistence fisherman, has a fish camp near Akiachuk. Mike, you use the word spiritual, and for a lot of city people, that might be a strange word. They think of spiritual being going to church, but you're talking about gathering food for the winter and fishing and that being spiritual. Give us a sense, you know, what does that mean to you in terms of using that word in this context?
Well, you know, I think, you know, when, you know, we've been in the fish camp, you know, every year, and it seems to give us a sense of, you know, sense of accomplishment being in the fish camp, and you're connected to the environment. And what the elders have been telling us, you know, the Creator provides us with the fish, and each year, you know, we have been surviving off the fish, and when we don't eat the fish, we seem to get physically weak, and I think with putting up the salmon and taking very good care of it, and making sure that the maggots don't get it, and trying to keep everything clean. The guts are spilled out into the middle of the river, and well, the seagulls are happy. And so the fish camp is quiet, and you know, we don't have any electricity. You know, we have wood stoves and we have cook stoves, everybody is doing some things, and we're gathered together, and we you know, the elders are telling stories and getting together to talk about the ways of life and the rules of living, and it just not just putting up fish, but the rules of life, and to keep yourself mentally healthy, to keep yourself physically healthy, and spiritually healthy, and we have. The sense of sharing in the fish camp, and I think that's what makes us resilient, and to have a sense of family, and also a connection with the Thamyo, which is the Creator, and we have been told, you know, over and over again that the unseen one provides, and that what he provides, we have to honor and respect and take good care of and keep everything clean. So, so I think that's to me. When I'm not at a fish camp, I'm. When I'm out in Bethel or when I'm out in Anchorage for a few days, I want to go back to the fish camp, and it's where I become strong again, and the sense of family, sense of accomplishment, and sense of security, and that we are going to be surviving another winter, and that is a good feeling.
Yeah, that's a beautiful statement, Mike. Very very much from the heart, and I identify completely with what you're saying. You know, that the idea that this fish is coming to you and it's a gift, and you've got to care for that gift and honor it, is something that is really very different from going to the grocery store and buying a piece of food in a plastic wrapper. Both might sustain you physically, but one sustains you in another way.
Yes, and every species does that and has a purpose. And I think with the you know, marine mammals, with the mammals living in the land, we're being provided, and we historically dependent on these resources, and we're continuously practicing what we were taught, and it's more than eating, it's more than surviving, it's something spiritual, and if we don't do it, then we are empty.
Yeah. Nancy, I want to, we're going to have a break in a minute here, but I wanted to ask you kind of the same question. I don't know if we put it in the same language, but from your writing, I have a sense of a spiritual link to these places and these resources. I don't know actually what anything about your religious beliefs, but do you identify at all with what Mike is saying?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's different in that it's, you know, it's sort of less, certainly less generational and less, you know, I don't know, inherent in my traditions. But I think certainly any of us who spend time close to the environment, you know, make or grow those connections of, you know, to me it's kind of, it's a sense of intimacy with the environment, you know, knowing where your food's coming from, recognizing the cycles of it and, you know, which runs come through at which time, and you know, handling and preparing your food and sharing it. So a lot of those things do translate. It's, you know, it's not as deep as what Mike's describing, but I think that it's something that's, you know, on some level it's a very human experience that we all share.
Yeah, it's something that we can understand and we can respect and hopefully develop some of our cultural and political practices around. And we're going to talk about that more in the second half of the show about how do we keep fish camp going? How do we keep these ways of life in place? There's political threats, there's climate threats, there's a lot of different things going on. And I also want to talk in the second half a little bit about how you do it exactly. How do you catch all those fish? Right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Calendar. The Eagle River Challenge will take place Saturday, August 17th at the Eagle River Nature Center. This 5K and 10K foot race will be held on the Dew Mound and Albert Loop trails. Bib pickup starts at 9 a.m. Race starts at 10 a.m. on August 17th. All proceeds benefit the Eagle River Nature Center. Register online at ernc.org. The Alaska Folk School in Talkeetna will host a class on local mushrooms on Wednesday, August 14th and 21st. Students will be introduced to mushroom identification techniques, search for mushrooms in the area, and apply classification skills. Common edible and non-edible species will be identified. The class will include a short presentation followed by a hike in an area of varied habitat to collect and identify mushrooms. On Saturday, August 17th, Bird TLC's Autumn Wings Festival will be held from noon to 4 p.m. in Anchorage. Activities will include booths with science, wildlife, outdoor, and recreational organizations, a live bird program, a bird calling contest, and a rehabilitated eagle release. For more info, go to birdtlc.net. And of course, you can find links to everything on alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show. But finally, in celebration of Alaska's lush blueberry season, the Blueberry Festival at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood is this weekend, August 10th and 11th. To tell us a little bit more about the festival, we have Amy Quisenberry from Alyeska Resort with us by phone. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Charles. Nice to talk to you.
Well, thanks for being with us. Just looking at the activities you've got, this is a very busy festival. You got a lot going on.
It is. We try to pack a lot into 2 days.
So tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, where is it going to be near the hotel there, or where is the main site of the festival?
Absolutely. It's going to take place from noon to 8 p.m. In the what we call the Hotel Pond Courtyard. So it's in the back of the hotel there, kind of right where you would load up on the tram.
Mm-hmm. And music, booths, what else going on?
We've got live music all weekend. Our headliner this year is called Dead Fish Orchestra, so they're kind of like a Grateful Dead fish cover band. We've also got Elena Lukina coming in, a violinist, and Aloha Bluegrass Band. We've got over 50 vendors, arts, crafts, food, nonprofits, all kinds of, you know, jewelry and potters and artists of all kinds. Kids events, we're going to have a fun run, a climbing wall, and then my favorite part of the event is the pie-eating contest.
Oh, blueberry pies, of course.
Of course, of course. So we line them up, and it's not how many you can eat, but it's how fast you can eat without your hands. It's a lot of fun, a lot of laughing.
So dive your face in, end up with
exactly.
A blue face. Right.
You got it.
Well, that sounds great. Blueberry season should be getting underway a little bit anyway up on the mountain.
Yeah, at least in the sunny area. So we'll fire up chair 7 there in the back of the hotel, and folks will be able to take the ride up the hill, and then families like to kind of make their way back down the hill looking for blueberries along the way.
Oh, great. And there's no fee or cost for involvement?
The festival is free.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So I'm wondering if it's a two-day affair. Are there rooms in the hotel this time of year, or is it all sort of full of visitors? Can people come down and spend 2 days at the festival?
You can, and there's, we offer a room package, so it kind of includes the overnight breakfast, tram rides, and folks can come and just stay for the entire weekend.
All right. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. So it's the Blueberry Festival, 10th and 11th, and give me the times again?
Noon to 8 p.m. in the Hotel Pond Courtyard.
All right. And folks can find more information about it by going through our website, alaskapublic.org, or I'm sure on your website for Alyeska Resort, which is a well-traveled website for all of our listeners.
Perfect.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Amy Quisenberry from Alyeska Resort, talking about the Blueberry Festival, which is coming up. And for links to that and all the other events on the calendar, go to alaskapublic.org. And if you have an event you want us to know about and want the public to know about, you can click on calendar and post your own event at alaskapublic.org. Please stay with us. We're going to take a short break here, and the second half of the show, we'll be back to talking more about Fish Camp when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is fish camp. We're talking about it from the point of view of Alaska subsistence fishermen. Mike Williams is with us. He's a leader in the communities in Lower Kuskokwim, Akiak, Akiachuk, fisherman, subsistence hunter, gatherer, and also a noted dog musher. Has done the Iditarod and you hear him on the radio all the time. He's got so much stuff going on. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
It's good to be here.
And Nancy Lord is with us from Homer. Nancy's an author of a number of different books about Alaskan topics, teaches writing as well, and spent many years set net fishing on the west side of Cook Inlet. And thank you for being with us, Nancy.
You're welcome.
There's so much change related to fishing and how we do these activities. Nancy, you were talking about changes in the SetNet culture in Cook Inlet and how you're no longer out there personally. Has there been a change in terms of how many people are doing it and how much money they're able to make since, you know, over the years?
You know, I don't know exactly, Charles, to answer that, but in Cook Inlet, as you know, there's just increasing competition among users. There's just so much going on in the inlet altogether and so many people wanting to share the fish resources that, you know, we've got commercial, sport, personal use, the dip netters and subsistence users, and not that huge a salmon resource, really. So it seems like every year there are more and more pressures upon it, plus all the other things that are going on that we've talked about, you know, climate change and ocean acidification, and all the developmental activities like potential coal and gold mines.
At times it seems so complicated for such a simple, wholesome activity. But, I mean, you've written about climate change and the warming of streams, which threatens salmon and all these other environmental threats. And it takes a little bit of the joy out of it, I think, because of the feeling that this resource that should be something that is there for us is kind of a big political hot potato and something that has to constantly be defended.
Yeah, I was thinking as we were talking earlier, too, I mean, it all comes down to the resource. And, you know, we all have that common, I assume it's a common desire to maintain the resource for ourselves and for the future. So if we, you know, can agree on that, then it becomes, you know, allocation issues.
Yeah. So for subsistence users in Southwest Alaska, it's been an especially tough time period in the last few years with the scarcity of king salmon. And we've got on the line with us James Davis, who's an attorney for fishermen who were arrested when they were trying to pursue their subsistence fishing. Mike is involved in that. Mike Williams, who's on the line with us. Mike, before we talk to James Davis, your attorney, set up for us a little bit what happened and how you got involved in the sort of the legal system.
Well, we've been you know, fishing for thousands of years, and that's historical. And I agree with the climate change impacts that. That we are experiencing in rural Alaska, and particularly it's having a substantial and adverse impacts on our people. And the temperature is increasing, the ice is melting, the animals are more diseased, and the fish are, you know, we're seeing more scars on the fish, and also, you know, the weather from the observation for about 50 years have really changed, particularly in year 2009. We had the driest July in 104 years. And of course, the 2.9 million acres burnt in the interior, and the fish didn't, minuscule returns of fish were happening. But there's larger patterns on the issue of climate change impacts, and I think it's impacting our way of life, and I agree with the issue of ocean acidification, and something is happening out in the ocean, and that is impacting the returns of the salmon. And I know that we have been talking about the bycatch issues by the pollock fishery, you know, we heard the number of 60,000 kings being thrown overboard, and we've heard those stories over and over again in news media. And while we have been pretty consistent in our numbers of catching fish, our population in our river have been consistently flat. And our catches of king salmon have been consistently flat, and that's how much we've used over the years. There's increased amount of population in the hub area, hub village, that's Bethel.
Yeah, Bethel.
And it used to be 600 people there, and it was a fish camp at one time, but there's about 8,000 people now. And I think that's where you know, we have to take a look at people going after the resource, and I agree with Ms. Lord that the competition for this species is getting harder. You know, there's.
But I mean, Mike, I don't want to interrupt you, but you were told you could not fish, or you couldn't fish for a week, right?
Yeah, we were closed for 7 days after a long winter, and we just could not. Reluctantly agreed, and we had a community meeting here in Accuyac because everybody was hungry. And the additional tack for 5 days was a bit too much, and the people were fishing with 4 inches, but the people were stretched by July, past mid-July, and we were getting nervous. And the elders told us we're hungry, and we need to get some salmon right now, or else, our life is empty, and we're, you know, we haven't had a fresh king salmon like we used to have in the past without being regulated, of course, these days, we're becoming more and more regulated due to the escapement concerns that we have seen in recent years. So, so everybody's pointing fingers
at each other. So you went out and you did fish, and did you get sighted?
There were 60 fishermen that went. Well, there were about I think 150 people went out fishing, and 60 people got sighted, about two-thirds of them pled guilty, and 22 fishermen pled not guilty, and they went through their trials, went through these trials this past spring, and that's the most unpleasant process that we have ever seen, and people don't want to do that, but the working group at that time last year at before the 7 days was over were recommending that we have an opportunity for folks to get even for 2 or 3 hours to fish to get food on the table, but that was not the case. It was, the place was slammed, and people had no other choice but to go get the food.
So, James Davis, you're an attorney for on a pro bono basis for some of the fishermen. Protesters isn't probably the right word if they're just going out to get food to feed themselves. What was the status of the case, and what were the main arguments that were made?
Thank you, Charles. Well, the status of all the cases that they're all on appeal now with the Alaska Court of Appeals, and we and the fishermen are making one fundamental argument, which is that subsistence is so important to Yupik spirituality that it should be protected as if a religion. And a Yupik elder, Robert Nick, came and testified on that issue, as did an anthropologist from Fairbanks. And we convinced the court that subsistence is so central to Yupik spirituality that it should be protected like religion. And the judge agreed with us on that. And he further agreed that the fishermen themselves sincerely held that religious or spiritual belief, and it should be protected. But he found that the king salmon were in such short supply that the state of Alaska had a right to effectively close down, you know, Yupik subsistence on the Kuskokwim that summer. So on that issue, we've appealed, saying that there were things the state could have done, aside from simply telling all Yupik people you can't catch any fish, that the state could have done to better accommodate Yupik spirituality, and the state didn't do that. It just acted ham-handedly and closed the entire fishery of Yupik people. And that's, we're saying that's unconstitutional.
And what is the defense? I guess the state would just say, well, if there's not enough fish, there's not enough fish. We're sorry about your spirituality. How do you counter that argument? I mean, if the fish aren't there, they're not there, right?
If they're not there, they're not there. But as with all religions, the state has to take all other steps before effectively terminating somebody's religion. For example, figuring out why they're not there. If you wait till you're in river and you say there's no fish there, but you're allowing the pollock fleet to catch and waste tens of thousands of king salmon, then you're asking the wrong question if the fish aren't in the river, because they may not be in the river because you're not taking proper enforcement action and you're not working with the federal government to limit the pollock fleet. It may also be the case, in fact, there were 20-plus thousand extra king salmon that the state allowed non-Yupik people to catch in Bethel. As Mike mentioned, Bethel has grown 10 times its size in the last 40 years. And if you've lived there for a year, you have no connection to resources except you just moved there to become a doctor at YKC, you can go out and catch 200 king salmon if you want to. Whereas if you're in a village and you're a Yupik person, your culture is centered around king salmon, they're intercepted in Bethel before they even get there. So the state could have regulated the fishery to say, who has the tightest, closest connection to this limited return of king salmon, and how can we allocate this limited return to those people with the most critical connection? But the state didn't ask that question. It simply closed the fishery down, reopened it, as Mike said, after the 12-day period for the red salmon returns, and 20,000 king salmon were caught during that time. The vast majority of those king salmon were caught by people living in Bethel. The vast majority of people living in Bethel are not Yupik people with a spiritual connection to the resource.
Mm. Do you, pulling back to the broader picture, James Davis, this sounds like a case that could very well go to the Alaska Supreme Court and define sort of a religious, the meaning of a religious practice for Alaskans. Is that true? Is this that kind of the heart of this is what is spirituality and what kind of priority does it create in our use of resources?
I think it does, and I think it's going to have statewide impact. I think what the state has never recognized is hunting and fishing for Native Alaskans is not what non-natives consider. It's so central to how they see the world and their place in the world that if it's going to be limited, and sometimes it may have to be because of a limited resource, it needs to be done in a thoughtful manner in consulting with the tribes and tribal agencies, and that generally doesn't happen in our state. It's just, you know, native hunting and fishing is considered just like non-native hunting and fishing. There aren't enough caribou. Nobody can go caribou hunting, but it's different for native people. And I think the state needs to be sensitive to that and try to figure out how to better accommodate native culture, native spirituality when it comes to fishing.
And I take it this will be going on for quite some time, this case.
Probably a number of years, yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, thanks for being with us, James Davis. He's representing the fishermen who were cited for subsistence fishing on the lower Kuskokwim. And James joins us from somewhere in the American West where he's vacationing. We appreciate your coming on with us.
Thank you, Charles.
All right. So I want to go back to you, Nancy Lord. You were waiting patiently while we were talking about that. And, you know, I don't think that as severe a case as that is, and it will be, you know, a constitutional decision that's made, I don't think that there's anywhere that the user conflicts are greater than in Cook Inlet. You know, the sport fishermen who feel that their fishing in the Kenai River and in the Mat Su Valley is the highest value and brings in a lot of money for the tourism economy. The personal use fishermen who are scooping them up with the dip nets, feeding their families. Commercial fishermen and, you know, drift net fishermen out in the inlet. And it seems like a source of just intense conflict where, you know, you would wish that these people who are all relying on the same resource could in some sense ally against the overall larger threats to the resource that we've talked a little bit about in terms of climate change, acidification, development, and so forth. Am I exaggerating that the level of conflict that sort of goes on among these users, or do you think that's true?
No, I don't think you're exaggerating at all. I think there's a high level of conflict, and I agree. It would be ideal if everyone could get together and you know, be very clear about, you know, conservation of the resource being number one, and then find some way to, you know, work with that. But I was actually one of the founding members of an organization called the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, which is a nonprofit group with a varied membership of commercial sport and subsistence users, and that was sort of the mission, or part of the mission of that group, to protect local use and community use of marine resources. So that's, and I think that's had a very positive influence or involvement. But I was thinking, in Cook Inlet, and, you know, I'm kind of fuzzy on the details anymore, but, you know, back when king salmon were very short in the late 60s, early 70s, king salmon fishing was shut down, including subsistence, and the people of Tyonek, who were really hurt by that, very much a subsistence culture at that time, went to court, and there was finally a subsistence fishery restored for those people after much hardship. So there, you know, we have many examples of trying to work through this in imperfect ways.
Yeah, and it seems like each generation has to do it over again. Going all the way back to when the bird seasons were closed in parts of Alaska, except the bird season was only open when there are no birds, you know, and that there had to be protests of Native people on that back in the 1960s. But one thing that's changed generationally is the number of people around and the number of people who are going after these fish. And the commercial fishing industry is limited in size by our limited entry system, but there's a lot, you know, it seems like the population steadily grows, but we can't really expect the salmon resource to grow. And Mike and James were talking about that down in Bethel, but it's perhaps even more so in Cook Inlet, where we have this big urban center.
Especially there's been a huge growth in the dip net fishery, which is really a relatively new fishery. And boy, if anyone has been to the Central Peninsula recently or passed through there, I mean, it sometimes seems as though all of Anchorage is there, catching, quote, their fish. And there's a good argument to make that Alaskans, should kind of have a real right to this common property resource, but it's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and the number of fish is not really going up. Mike, I don't know if you have anything more to add on that. I know you're anxious to get down to your fish camp, and we've got a video on our website at alaskapublic.org showing a fish camp up in Norvik, and I've seen other fish camps. I've seen fish camps where people have basketball hoops set up, and it's like the whole village has moved out to the camp. And just sort of on the lighter side, it's a lot of fun going on down there. I mean, do you want to get out there and just sort of get in on the social time and the fun?
Yeah, we have basketball hoops.
Oh, you do?
And the kids have, right now the sun's out and everybody is in the beaches, and all those kids are swimming in the beaches, and it's just It's a hard life, but I think there's got to be some other recreational activities for the kids. And you know, what we've been able to do before is, you know, we had some summer library program that these guys from the library were dropping off books over the years, and that's how my kids started to enjoy reading. You know, it's not just all work, but and what we were able to do is to read all the time and read to the kids, and it really helped with their reading interest, you know, books and et cetera. But I think, you know, with all of these hard issues that we're dealing with, I think the burden of conservation lands on our lap here, and we're having to deal with it. And but of course, there needs to be more done to protect that and manage that, you know, in the high seas and in 3 mile along the coastline and before the fish enters the rivers. But I think with this controversy, I think, you know, we did not protest fish. And let me explain a little bit that we have been fishing for a long, long time. And this is what we do, and this is what we were taught to do every year. And people may say that well, we were doing civil disobedience and protest fishing. It's not that.
You were just fishing, yeah.
Yeah, we were fishing for our survival, and that's a huge difference.
Yeah. And we're just about out of time, Mike. I hate to interrupt you there, but I think that what you're saying is very true, and that hopefully the function that we can provide is, if there's more awareness between urban and rural Alaska about the meaning of these activities, then maybe that helps people recognize the need for conservation and for fairness and allocation. And I know
we need more conversations.
That's right. And thank you, Nancy, for your role in this as a writer and also as a conservationist. And thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you both. Nice to be sharing the stage with you, Mike.
Yeah, thanks to Mike. Thanks to Nancy. Also, James Davis was with us earlier, and Amy Quisenberry talking about the Blueberry Festival down at Alyeska. My name is Charles Woolforth. That's all for Outdoor Explorer today. We invite you to join the conversation with us on Facebook. Just check out Outdoor Explorer and give us your ideas about what you'd like to see on future shows. Kristen Speck is our producer and audio engineer today. My name is Charles Woolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.